You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast here on WVIK Public Radio, the flagship public radio station of the Quad Cities, Eastern Iowa and Northwestern Illinois. I'm very pleased to have on as a guest today Josh Kroschauer, who's the political reporter for the National Journal and the host of the Against the Grain podcast, which I've been following here for a while. And it's really a good take on our politics and some provocative guests. So I recommend it to my listeners out there as well. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we're at a point where it looks like finally we're going to get the winner, Joe Biden, declared soon, hopefully, and move forward. But I guess, is it too soon to start looking back on this era, this tumultuous era we've been through since Donald Trump was elected, but really before then, and draw some longer-term conclusions about what we've been through? What caused this, and is this going to be with us for a while, the Trumpism, and where do we go from here?
That's a great question, and I think you almost have to look beyond just Donald Trump and kind of look at our politics in the last, say, 10 years. And, you know, starting with, frankly, former President Obama, there was sort of a trend toward celebrity politicians, people who, you know, became cult of personality leaders and developed a real hold on their followers. And I wrote about this a lot during the Obama years, especially towards the end of his presidency, where, you know, his base, no matter what he did, no matter what policy he pursued, had a pretty strong hold on 95% of the party. And I think a lot of the excesses, ideological excesses, in particular, I mean, I remember when Obama lost the Senate in the 2014 midterms, he made comments along the lines of saying, look, the people that didn't vote it are the ones who we need to listen to, and I don't think this is a mandate for anything, and proceeded to do a lot of executive orders, kind of ignoring the will of the voters that showed up in the midterm election. And that radicalized the right. I think it gave an opening for Donald Trump to really emerge out of nowhere to win the Republican nomination. And he took that playbook of playing to the base and just pissing off the opposition, and he put it on steroids and really divided the country in a very, I think, harmful way over the last 4 years. Opportunity, I think, with Biden winning the election, someone who's an institutionalist, someone who is not a cult of personality type of politician, is someone who has been in Washington for a long time, is a former vice president, a longtime senator. He offers the promise of somehow cooling that heated tribalism down. We don't know how things are going to turn out in these next 4 years, but I think you can look at the election results as something of an end of an era, where voters may have been divided as they've never been before. There were Republicans and Democrats, Trump voters and Biden voters. But there was also a critical mass of folk who I think rejected the extremes of both sides. You had Biden winning by a pretty decisive, about a 4 or 5 point margin when all is said and done. But you also had Republicans holding the Senate, or at least holding 50 seats in the Senate, depending on what happens in Georgia. And you had Republicans, against all expectations, picking up seats, quite a few seats in the House, and really taking advantage of races where the Democratic candidate turned out to be too far to the left of a lot of these more moderate districts in the country. So if there's a mandate, if there was a message sent to the country, it's that they want normalcy. They elected a candidate, a president, who promised to return to some degree of normalcy. And I think, you know, the incentives, I mean, we are still a divided country, where Trump has sort of pushed the country to, in many ways, to the brink ideologically, with people taking sides, families being split apart by politics in some cases. But I think the future is looking a little more brighter when it comes to just the quality of our leadership, because you have a newly elected president, a president-elect in Joe Biden, who has made an argument of trying to work along bipartisan lines and actually picking a cabinet that really reflects a lot of the messages he sent out on the campaign trail.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you just made. Maybe COVID is a slight sliver of good coming from it, is keeping families apart for Thanksgiving that might be fighting and throwing forks at each other over politics, which happened last year. But I'm curious what you think as far as which party is going to have more of a heavy lift moving forward. The Republicans, of course, were pretty much taken over by Donald Trump's philosophy, which in several ways is diametrically opposed to the party of Ronald Reagan and his philosophy in trade, immigration, nationalism. And the Democrats have their own problems as well that's already come forward in battles between the progressive wing and the moderate wing. Which one faces the heavier lift, do you think, moving forward?
Well, they both face their own challenges. You have two parties that are pretty divided. You have a Democratic Party that looks like it may be in the middle of a civil war between the more pragmatic, moderate voices that make up the majority in the House, that make up so many of these key senators that allow legislation to get passed through Congress. But you also have an ascendant progressive wing, which is looking for its share of power in a Biden administration. You know, we saw some of the battle lines being drawn in the aftermath of the election when you had more moderate Democratic Congress members like Abigail Spanberger and Connor Lamb going after a more prominent progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And they went back and forth about why Democrats didn't live up to expectations in the down ballot election. You may see that in the future. I think with a narrowly divided House, progressives are going to try to create holy hell for Nancy Pelosi, and there's going to be a lot of internal turmoil. That said, when you're the party in power, when you have the presidency, usually the president does a lot to stamp out internal dissent. I mean, we learned that in the last 4 years when, you know, I spent many years in Washington covering the rise of the Freedom Caucus of the Tea Party, giving John Boehner and Paul Ryan all these political headaches. The second Donald Trump became president, a lot of those internal divisions ended up getting papered over, because when you have power, you're actually able to do things. You're not as aggrieved. Even progressives who only get a quarter loaf of what they want, it's more than getting nothing. So, you know, these are very real divisions. These are very real ideological differences within a party that, frankly, included socialists like Bernie Sanders that voted for Biden, and Republicans like John Kasich voted for Biden as well. So there's going to be some challenges that Biden's going to have to face. But I will say that it's generally a little easier when you're in power to kind of give the spoils of victory to everyone and keep everyone in line because of that. You know, for the Republicans, I frankly think there's going to be a lot more anarchy if there's a civil war that's been going on in the Democratic Party. I think there's going to be a lot more anarchy within the Republican Party's future as they try to figure out what the party is going to be all about in the post-Trump era. Now, certainly Trump is going to try to keep his stamp on the party. He wants to maintain power even out of office. But I also think that he's shown a certain lack of discipline and competence in his presidency, certainly, but also in kind of figuring out how to win elections. He's lost his party quite a few seats in Congress and in governorships, and you got to give him credit. He turned out a whole lot of voters. He got more of the vote share than he did in 2016, even though he lost. There's clearly a big base within the Republican Party that likes Trump more than the institution of the Republican Party. But that said, when he's out of office and he doesn't have power, it's going to be a real challenge. It's going to be harder to keep control of the party infrastructure. And there are going to be a lot of Republicans that look at the challenging midterm elections in 2022 and also want to win the presidency in 4 years. And they're going to question whether, you know, hitching their wagon to Trump is the wise political move going forward. So, I actually think people overstate the impact that Trump is going to have on the party going forward. I think we're kind of almost going in a reverse mode from where we were in 2017, where Trump is losing power over the party instead of kind of gaining power as president. And I think there's going to be sort of a period of anarchy where you're going to have half dozen factions trying to create their own vision of what the Republican Party should look like, and they're going to be fighting it out, and then Trump is going to be on the sidelines tweeting things, creating some chaos there as well. So, I think you always want to be the party in power. I think I would much rather be Joe Biden. I would much rather be, the Democratic Party looking forward. But they have a lot of divisions as well, and the Republican Party does have opportunities because this election was a lot closer than people expected.
Yeah, I mean, Trump did amazingly well. When you look at the numbers of votes, the second highest number of votes in history, he brought a lot of people out to the polls. A lot of these states were a lot closer than what everybody thought they would be. I guess I've been thinking lately about what the forces that brought Trump to power and caused a share of people, and people out here are familiar, of course, with the Obama-Trump phenomenon. We're in the heart of it out here in the Midwest heartland. But do you feel like the establishment in Washington and both parties understands and accepts what happened, at what caused Trump to rise? And or do you think that it's just going to be, this is just a blip, we're going to go back to the way things were? I mean, since 2000 anyway, our government really hasn't performed well, both internationally and here at home with the two wars, but also with the fallout from the Great Recession.
No, unfortunately, I don't think enough people really learned the lessons of the last two elections, one in which Trump won, one in which Trump lost, but both of them showed he had a deep and abiding base of support throughout the country. And, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, frankly, one of the problems with the Democratic Party in the last 4 years is essentially to label anyone who identifies with some of Trump's agenda as being racist or being a white supremacist, or as Hillary Clinton said in the 2016 campaign, to her ultimate detriment, calling these folks deplorable people. I mean, this is the heart of why Trump has thrived. And there are a lot of reasons people voted for Trump, a lot of legitimate ones. But I think the drive, and I've written about this extensively, but the driving factor is sort of this cultural elitism, the fact that you know, half the country isn't being heard by the elites and the power brokers in Washington, New York, and Los Angeles. And, you know, I don't think a lot of leaders in the party learned that lesson. You still see some of these same mistakes being made by Democratic Party leaders, even in victory. In fact, I guess one of the more encouraging signs, frankly, is that when they lost at least 10 House seats, and that came as a major surprise to party leaders, it actually did prompt the reckoning within the party. It did raise questions about, well, maybe we shouldn't have been so indulgent of rioters, you know, during those protests that took place over the summer. Maybe we need to have a message that's more inclusive instead of trying to divide the country along people who we like and people we don't like. I mean, there's an economic component, there's a cultural component, but you know, the umbrella argument I would make is that there's just a disrespect of people who are different from the leadership, and there hasn't been that kind of empathy on either side, frankly, to listen to what other people have to say, what their interests are, and why they become alienated from a Democratic Party that's increasingly based in our liberal coasts or New York, D.C. and California. Now, I think there's some hope that the election, I mean, Biden is certainly, he may have been the only Democratic nominee for president that actually could have connected well enough with enough voters in the Midwest and in parts of the country to win this election. I mean, I don't think that Elizabeth Warren, I think if you look at the results, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, I don't think they could have won an election against Donald Trump, given now that we know what the results are. And I think Biden's success and the challenges that certain Democrats have faced continuously in winning over mainstream voters, I think is a lesson to them. The question is, do they internalize it? Do they understand that they need to moderate their own message to win over a majority of the country?
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio here in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Josh Kroshauer, who's the political editor of the National Journal and host of the Against the Grain podcast. You brought up an interesting point, and I think I agree with you that Biden probably was the only candidate that could have won against Donald Trump this time. And these pivot counties, so-called pivot counties, that are counties that Barack Obama won twice, and then Donald Trump won in 2016, as you know, were mostly situated right here in the Midwest. And in fact, in the area, in our listening area, Iowa had the most of these. And I just did a little research before we started here, and of these counties, nationwide, 85% stayed with Donald Trump so far. All some votes are still coming in, and every single one in Iowa stayed with Trump.
Yep.
So it looks like that anyway, in the short term, that the Republicans perhaps have won these voters over. And if a guy like Joe Biden with his working class background in Scranton, as you mentioned, can't get them, it looks like they're probably gone for the Democratic Party.
I think that's correct on the larger trend. So I do think, you know, Biden now has 4 years to prove that his message can work and that he has an agenda that can actually reach out to the communities where he didn't fare as well in this most recent election. You know, Iowa is frankly one of the most fascinating political states on the map because you are the most persuadable state in the country. There were more Obama Trump voters in Iowa than in any other state in the country, and you know your home congressional district Ashley Hinson, the Republican congresswoman-elect, is something of a model, I think, to what Republicans can be in the future. Someone who, you know, certainly has experience in the state legislature, someone who was on television as a TV anchor in Des Moines, but it's someone who also talked about bipartisanship, wasn't running on necessarily a Trumpian message, but focused on sort of conservative principles and even some bipartisanship in her campaign message. And she was one of those Republican challengers that unseated the Democrat who just got elected in 2018. So, I mean, Iowa is, you know, even though the top of the ticket there was a sort of a similarity to what we saw in the 2016 results, we certainly saw the type of lawmakers. I think Hinson is going to be a model for the type of Republican Party that would do well in the future, someone who could appeal to a wide swath of voters and win over even some of those Donald Trump and Joe Biden voters in her home district.
That's an interesting point, because it certainly looks like a lot of the Republicans that won House seats were women. And it's now coming out a little bit. I've read where there was a conscious strategy of recruitment to get women running, and even some women with military backgrounds. So it looks like that may be an interesting part of the Republican strategy to win some of these House seats across the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I wrote about that in a column right before the election, that almost every one of the top Republican House recruits was either a woman or a minority, and you know, including in some conservative parts of the country, but also in more Democratic friendly parts of the country, like South Florida, Orange County, California, which flipped to the Democrats in the last election, ended up becoming much more Republican in certain races this time around. That should tell you the future of the Republican Party. Trump is certainly going to be trying to exert his influence as a former president from the outside, but you're going to have a much more diverse Republican caucus going into Washington, and you're going to have more voices that are pragmatic as part of Kevin McCarthy's Republican caucus, and that makes a difference. Like, when you have a diversity of ideology, a diversity of views within a caucus, it's going to shape the future of the party as well. So, I mean, like I said, I expect there to be a period of sort of anarchy between many, many different visions and no controlling leader to really get the party in line, which can be good or bad, I guess, depending on your point of view. But make no mistake, like, Republicans recognize that, you know, there are certain elements of Trump's message that were very appealing, and it's, you know, focused on the working class, the forgotten Americans. That was very appealing to voters in the heartland. It wasn't just Iowa, Ohio, Wisconsin. I mean, even states he lost, he did much better than the polls anticipated. He's realigned the electorate, frankly, along class-based lines. So you do have working-class Americans becoming increasingly Republican, even as more educated, kind of elite, affluent Americans end up becoming more Democrat. So he is a historic figure in that he sort of accelerated a realignment of the parties, and that's going to be long-lasting. But I also think there's some interesting opportunities Republicans showcased in this election as well, down ballot. They have a pretty impressive freshman class of diverse recruits who I think are going to be future stars within the Republican Party as well.
It's amazing the realignment you're talking about. FDR's got to be rolling over in his grave with the white working class voters, and even Hispanic, which research is coming out now, and since the election, a lot of Hispanic Latino voters of working class backgrounds supported Trump more so than anybody thought. So it's really interesting to see. I'll be watching for if Biden makes an attempt to get some of the working class back on his side. But do you think some of these Trump working class voters, now that Biden's won, I know Trump's still battling this, but do you think they're going to stay with the Republican Party? I mean, to me, the options, I don't think there's three options, you know, stay Republican, go with Biden, or just drop out. I think it's either staying Republican or dropping out. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it really does depend on how Joe Biden governs. I mean, like you said, I don't think a lot of folks thought that Donald Trump would dramatically improve on his performance with Hispanics. But being the incumbent and actually delivering on policies that were beneficial to these communities, and it wasn't just immigration, it was a lot of economic-related issues. But also, you know, you look at being able, I mean, look at the economy before the pandemic, and that actually, I think, was a powerful argument for Trump. I mean, people sort of priced the pandemic into the equation and didn't blame Trump quite as much as I think the commentary suggested. And, you know, there were real economic gains by agricultural workers in Iowa, by a lot of blue collar workers across the country. I mean, you can actually see the wages that went up in the previous 4 years before the pandemic. And I think Trump got the benefit of the doubt with a lot of those voters. So look, if Joe Biden, you know, if the vaccine is distributed equitably and effectively, and the economy starts booming again in 2021, and people feel much more optimistic about their future, I do think a lot of these voters that voted for Obama in Iowa and, you know, in swing states across the country, people who are less partisan but identify with Trump, some of parts of Trump's message, I do think they're winnable for Biden or for a future Democratic nominee. But you can't just expect them to come back into the fold without any work. And Democrats did their best to alienate these voters, frankly, over the last 4 years.
I want to talk about polling real quick. Polling was way off in most races, with some enormous consequences, I think, on how everybody was looking at these races, and perhaps with fundraising implications for races that maybe donors thought were not going to be competitive. I'm sure you've been talking to a lot of folks out in Washington. What's the state of the polling industry right now? Can it recover? I mean, I think that's a legitimate question right now, and that I would imagine a lot of candidates and leaders in the parties are thinking, why are we paying all this money if the results aren't accurate?
Yeah, you're no doubt about it. That one of the biggest losers from this election was the polling industry. And I'm not just talking about the media pollsters. In fact, you guys in Iowa have probably one of the best pollsters in the country. And Ann Selzer, who's Des Moines Register poll, got the final results pretty accurate in the Senate race and the presidential race. But, you know, there's been a lot of really poor media-backed polling. And it wasn't just that. It was also partisan polling. I mean, you look at where parties spent money, which races they thought were the most competitive, and it's clear that both Republicans and Democrats missed how favorable the map was in certain areas to Republicans. And they didn't, you know, Republicans didn't spend in certain areas where they probably could have picked up another handful of seats if they had a different strategic tack. So the polling was not just off, you know, by the media folks, but also by the people who pay a lot of money to get polls right in the parties. You know, there are a lot of theories being thrown about with some evidence to them. I mean, there are two that kind of, I think, are most plausible for why the polling was so off. I mean, number one, it's clear that a lot of the new Trump voters that don't necessarily participate in typical midterm elections, typical, you know, they're not frequent voters, but turned out because of President Trump, they're not answering the phone. They don't like talking to pollsters. They don't trust pollsters. And it's clear that it's been really hard to reach these sort of low-trust Trump or Republican voters, and it makes it hard for pollsters to capture that slice of the electorate, even as they tried pretty hard to account for that mistake that they made in 2016. I also think that there's an almost more obvious reason why the polling, because all the polling was not just off by, you know, in different directions. It was all in favor of Democrats and Joe Biden. I mean, almost every poll was biased and against Republicans. There wasn't error in both directions. And, you know, I think there's been some post-election analysis that suggests that there are a number of Trump voters that don't want to talk about supporting Trump. It's not politically fashionable to say you support Trump or to support Republicans that support Trump. So, there was a Republican pollster that did a post-election analysis that found that a significant share of the Trump vote were college-educated women in the suburbs who just were accused of being racist or were excommunicated by their friends if they said anything conservative or anything favorable towards the president. And that has an impact on how people are going to be willing to talk to random strangers on the phone. You know, I think we still need to look at more analysis to see how much of an effect the shy Trump vote, the shy Trump effect, I should say, had on the polling. But clearly there are a lot of, because of the divisions in the country, because people who, you know, looked at people differently based on who they voted for president, if you voted for President Trump. I mean, a lot of people were just afraid, frankly, of sharing their opinions. I mean, and also, and especially in bluer parts of the country, you could even lose your job. I mean, you could actually lose your employment. There are many high profile cases where people said heterodox opinions in the workplace and they lost their employment. They lost their job and livelihood. So, I mean, I think there's a real fear out there, especially in some of the bluer parts of the country, that if you have a contrary opinion, if you're for President Trump, that was not something you wanted to share, either publicly or to a pollster.
We just have like 1 minute left, and I'm going to drop a real tough question on you here, so try to condense. But do you think the media was fair to Trump over the course of his presidency, or did they pile on too much?
Well, look, no. I mean, I've been concerned about the media's increasing willingness to kind of insert their own opinions. I'm generalizing here, but you know, not just cable news, but even some of the more established print outlets. There was sort of a decline in standards. And I understand, you know, Trump sort of he courted that. He welcomed, he liked to call people in the media fake news and tried to call them the enemy of the state. And then I think a lot of people in the media weren't professional enough to just tune that noise out and kind of just treat him like any president and report the facts. And people can make smart judgments based on the facts. They don't need, you know, a lot of commentary in the news coverage. So I think, you know, in a weird way, Trump almost discredited them. He used a tactic by condemning the media, by treating the press as fake news. He baited the press into actually being what he was calling them in many ways. The standards were dropped, no doubt. Now, you know, Trump did a whole lot of abnormal things that needed to be covered and needed to be held accountable at the same time. So we kind of get to this like chicken and egg argument, which started, I mean, I think Trump's, you know, the lack of norms that Trump kind of enjoyed kind of flouting really drove the press batty and then made the press not live up to some of the high standards that it was used to uphold in. You know, but I also worry about sort of the larger trends in media where speed is more important than accuracy in the digital age. And, you know, corrections aren't getting as much attention as the mistake in the first place. You know, that's a challenge. I mean, I think Trump really broke many aspects of the press. And he in a way was a blessing and a curse. He gave a lot of outlets record traffic. People were wanted to read the New York Times every day to see what was going on. But it also created this ideological bubble where people were subscribing to the New York Times or were watching CNN because they wanted to, you know, have their biases confirmed. And in many ways, we got away from reporting just the facts and instead needed to too many people were trying to add their own opinion or their own edge to the coverage. So I think that's unfortunate. I don't know if we can get that trust back. That's not easily recovered. But look, I think there are individual reporters, individual news outlets that have done a better job, and hopefully those are the people and those are the institutions that people trust going forward.
Well, a lot to be following here, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today to kind of sort this out. And my guest today on Heartland Politics has been Josh Krauschauer, who's the political editor of the National Journal and host of the Against the Grain podcast. Josh, thanks so much for being on, and we'll be following this and hope to have you back sometime.
We'll love to. We'll hope to be on soon.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.